journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass dissent.
These are weapons of mass dissent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Friday, April 24th, 2009, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar.
Silence is not an option.
Three back-to-back suicide bombings kill hundreds in Iraq. We'll speak with Dar Jamail. The effects of climate change on indigenous people, and a conversation with writer Douglas Haddo about pornography, and this week's Black Agenda report.
But I can't help myself, why should I?
This is Uprising. Good morning and welcome to Uprising. In what was the bloodiest day in Iraq so far this year, two suicide bombings killed more than 70 people yesterday. The first attack took place in the national capital of Baghdad when a suicide bomber detonated explosives near Iraqi national police officers who were handing out aid. At least 25 were then killed, six of whom were members of the police force. The second and deadliest attack occurred nearly an hour later west of Baquba, the provincial capital of Diyala, at a local restaurant crowded with Iranian pilgrims. The blast killed 47 people and injured at least 69 more. Two more bombings followed in the cities of Tikrit and Mosul as Iraqi authorities claim the violence was spurred by the arrest and perpetrated Sunni insurgent leader and Al-Qaeda member Abu Omar al-Baghdadi. However, even the U.S. Army has speculated previously that al-Baghdadi could be a fictitious figure in the movement. Just this morning, more than 60 people were killed and 125 wounded by two suicide bombers near a Shiite shrine in Baghdad. The spate of bombings in the last 48 hours, however, were only the most recent in an ever-increasing upsurge in violence in Iraq this month. Between April 16th and 20th, numerous suicide bombings and mortar attacks claimed the lives of 54 Iraqis. Joining me on the line this morning is Dar Jamail. He is an independent journalist who writes for the Interpress Service and Le Monde Diplomatique, as well as Truthout. He's the author of Beyond the Green Zone, Dispatches from an Unembedded Journalist in Occupied Iraq. Welcome to Uprising, Dar.
Thank you, Sonali. Good to be with you.
Good to be with you, too. So these various suicide bombings I read about were quite violent and very dramatic. Over 100 people in just 48 hours and hundreds wounded. What do you attribute this to? Are they coordinated, do you think?
I think it is coordinated. I think it's a resurgence of al-Qaeda operations in Iraq, and it's a direct result of the fact that the U.S. military, who created and stood up and supported the al-Sawa force, the 100,000-strong Sunni militia, al-Sawa means Sons of Iraq, this was the force largely responsible for doing away with al-Qaeda, for running security in their areas of control around parts of Iraq, and they were very effective. We haven't seen bombings like this for a long time, but now we're seeing a resurgence because for two main reasons. One, the U.S. Has ceased supporting al-Sawa in most areas of Baghdad and other places around Iraq and turned control over to the Iraqi government. And then the second main reason is that Iraqi government is not only not bringing them into the security forces as promised, but they're not even paying them. And in fact, they're going out and targeting their leadership and detaining as many of the al-Sawa as they can get their hands on. So we've seen instances of Sawa walking away from their security posts, of protesting, threatening to go out and start planting roadside bombs again, since most of them are former members of the resistance. Some of them are even al-Qaeda members themselves. And so because of that, they're not carrying out their security duties, hence a dramatic increase in the resurgence of al-Qaeda. And I don't expect this to stop anytime soon.
Now, this person, Abu Omar al-Baghdadi, who is he? He was reported as having been killed previously by the United States, but apparently that was not true, and he has now been arrested. Who is he, and is he one of these leaders?
No, he's not. He seems to be a fictitious character so far. There's been no hard evidence whatsoever given to even prove that this individual exists. The U.S. military stated recently that they don't even have one name of like that for an al-Qaeda member in Iraq. They don't believe he exists either. And what's interesting is the timing of the Iraqi government's release of his alleged capture, which came just a couple of hours after the second major suicide bombing of yesterday. I think it's a desperate propaganda attempt to try to appear as though they have some sort of control over a situation which, A, they don't have control of, and, B, they're basically complicit in.
So who's making him up? Is it the Iraqi military?
It seems to be the Maliki government. I don't think it's the Iraqi military. It seems to be Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki's government who, they're feeling very threatened and very much in a corner by this huge upsurge, this huge spasm of violence that doesn't seem to be going away anytime soon. And, B, they need to sort of portray to the Iraqi people that they have some sort of control and that they will be able to bring the situation under control, because we have to remember that Maliki, one of the reasons he was so popular in the recent provincial elections the end of this January was because security had gotten so much better than it was compared to, say, in 2006, 2007. But now in the last week, this is exactly what it looked like Iraq in 2006 and up to the middle of 2007. And I think his government is deeply, deeply concerned about this.
Well, many people who were critics of the so-called surge strategy that included paying off these fighters predicted that once this payment stopped, that you would see a corresponding upsurge. That seems to be coming true right now. Dar, do you see most of the targets over these past several days and earlier in the month being primarily Shiite targets because the Sawa movement is Sunni dominated?
No, I think certainly, as you said, the targets are primarily Shia. We saw today one of the most important shrines in Iraq had two major suicide bombings, a Shia shrine, and most of the other targets have been either Shia pilgrims or Shia markets, etc. And this is because, I mean, this is how al-Qaeda operates. Al-Qaeda is an extremist Sunni group, not directly tied with al-Sawa or the Iraqi resistance, but they believe, of course, in the only pure Muslim is Sunni of their brand, and all Shia must therefore be eradicated. And so I think that, you know, the smacks of al-Qaeda, this is exactly the same sorts of bombings we saw when they were really at their peak through 2006 and in early 2007.
But as you said, there is a little overlap between al-Qaeda and al-Sawa.
There is, and it's, you know, everything in Iraq is complex. You can't be cut and dry or black and white about anything, and it is possible that some of these former or even current Sawa members have decided to go back to their al-Qaeda roots, because some of them absolutely are infiltrators for al-Qaeda, so that's certainly possible. But I think overall, most of the Sawa who are deciding to abandon their post and start carrying out attacks, they're going back into kind of classic Iraqi resistance attacks, planting roadside bombs. We just recently saw three Sawa members were arrested by Iraqi forces just south of Baghdad planting roadside bombs, and this is becoming a daily occurrence now. And this is why we're also seeing a relatively dramatic increase in the number of roadside bomb attacks.
So roadside bomb attacks increasing because of Sawa members, suicide bombings increasing, very likely a result of al-Qaeda tactics.
Exactly.
And all of that happening at the same time.
Exactly. And all of this is a direct result of, as I said before, it was only a matter of time before when the U.S. stopped paying al-Sawa and when the government attacks on them continued as they have since October, which was the initial month they were supposed to be rolled over into the government security forces. When I was there in Iraq in this past February, I actually spoke with Sawa members around Baghdad. Many of them had said, look, we haven't been paid since October. We're having trouble keeping our people under control. They're getting very angry, and the government has been targeting us. This is not going to last much longer before we start fighting back.
Dar Jamil, now why is the government targeting al-Sawa instead of incorporating them into the security forces as had been promised? It seems like an obvious recipe for disaster.
Well, it is, but we have a Maliki administration, a predominantly Shia government that feels very threatened by the al-Sawa. They do not want these people to have political power. They fear that if they roll them into the government security apparatus and start paying them, it's going to legitimize them and give them more of a position of political power, so that in the upcoming national elections, they'll be better suited to have some of their candidates in higher positions in the government. And they feel threatened by that, and also they believe, look, these are people who've been carrying out attacks against the government in the past, and now it's our chance, now that we know who they are, since they're in the Sawa and they're standing out on the streets of Iraq running security operations, now it's our chance to actually go out and pick these people up and put them in jail for what we think they've done in the past. And so these are really the two main reasons why the government is going after these guys. And again, I don't see this stopping. The U.S. is not putting any pressure on the Maliki government to stop that or find other ways to try to invoke reconciliation. And the government, of course, is feeling more and more threatened by the day.
So you bring up the U.S., which, of course, we must talk about, being that it is the sort of major context for all of this. Basically, what we're seeing is a civil war breaking out into even greater depth than before. But the United States is drawing down its forces at the same time, and many outposts by the United States are likely going to close very soon. Where does the U.S. figure in this, notwithstanding, of course, the context of the occupation itself, but even just in these current dealings? As you said, the U.S. is not pressuring al-Maliki to try to incorporate these forces into the security forces, but what else is the government doing, the U.S.?
Well, it's amazing that they're really not doing anything right now to stop this. They've put themselves in a position where they're not going to pressure the Maliki government, and they're certainly not going to reincorporate the Sawa and start paying them again, because A, the money's just not there, and B, I don't think they have the facilities to do that as they did before. But I'm very hesitant to start talking about the U.S. Well, they're really making moves to start closing down outposts and things of this nature, because it was just within the last about week and a half that General Odierno said, look, I know there's this June 30 deadline to start pulling out of the cities because of the status of forces agreement, but we're going to be handling that on a city-by-city basis, and already basically said that, for example, up in Mosul, where the city is largely out of the control of both the U.S. military and the Iraqi government forces, that the U.S. Will likely be staying in there after June 30th. And then he came out a day or two after that and said, look, and then there might be other cities that we have to do the same thing. So once again, we're seeing this big rhetoric come out talking about withdrawal and pulling out of cities and respecting agreements, et cetera. And then in the aftermath, we're starting to see kind of the fine print come out where they say, well, but there may well be exceptions, or we'll leave that up to the Iraqi government, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm going to be very surprised if come June 30 we see a total withdrawal of all U.S. forces onto the bases and out of the cities. I just don't think we're going to see that happen, especially now in light of we're still, a long ways in front of that deadline, over a couple of months still, and we're seeing the biggest upsurge in violence in Iraq in about 2 years.
So, does it seem to you that this enormous upsurge in violence could possibly be a pretext for the Obama administration, or could be used as a pretext by the Obama administration to either prolong the war or even get back into it?
I think it will, because if this amount of violence continues, it's going to be very easy for them to say, look, we have to do this. We have to go back in. We have to actually, instead of taking troops out of Iraq and putting them into Afghanistan, we're going to need to keep more there, or maybe even start sending even more to Iraq. If this continues, I'd be very, very surprised if they didn't take one of those tacks.
But even if the U.S. did withdraw completely, how would it change anything on the ground with these sorts of attacks that we're seeing currently? I mean, would these attacks start slowing down or stop, or would they simply keep increasing?
Well, it's really difficult to say, because the reality is, when we look at everyone being killed in Iraq today, it's a direct or indirect result of U.S. policy there through the occupation. If the Sawa had never existed, the Iraqi resistance themselves were taking out al-Qaeda in all the areas where they were not being hampered in going after al-Qaeda by U.S. military forces. This was documented even by the U.S. military itself. We would certainly see bloodshed continue as different groups are struggling struggling for political power. There hasn't been a whole lot of reconciliation. But again, the U.S. has continued to support one group and then not another, and then switching sides and giving another group more support than another different group, and playing sides off of one another, running the sectarian-based death squads that really led to most of the violence through 2006, 2007. So again, in most of these instances, not to say the Iraqis do not have a role, of course they do, but in most of these instances, the larger aspects of why some of these horrendous events have been set up that are generating so much death, it's all a result of U.S. policy in Iraq. And the bottom line is none of this sort of thing, whether it's al-Qaeda operations or massive sectarian violence, none of this existed prior to the U.S. invasion of Iraq.
So then continuing the conversation about the U.S. occupation continuing or not continuing, it's almost a moot point, would you say? And really what needs to happen is the pressure on the Maliki government to try to draw down this unfolding civil war and diplomatic means, a diplomatic role for the United States.
Well, I think so. I think, you know, the first thing the Maliki government should do that I think would have a dramatic effect on the situation and to improve it would be to incorporate the SAWA, start bringing them in as promised months ago into the security forces. And the U.S. Is certainly in a position where they could pressure the Maliki government to do that. Because if they did that, these people would be paid. They would be then have legitimate security positions in the Iraqi police and in the Iraqi military, and they would certainly resume their operations of going after al-Qaeda. And I think we'd see a dramatic decline in the number of attacks being carried out. And then, of course, they would cease their operations. SAWA would cease their operations in attacking government forces and U.S. forces.
But the al-Qaeda would not necessarily cease their operations. If anything, they might escalate them.
Well, and that's my point. But if the SAWA were paid once again and stopped being targeted by, if the government ceased their targeting operations against them and rolled them into the security forces, then SAWA would go back to resuming their security operations and going after al-Qaeda, because they were the ones that actually, they were the only ones, including the U.S. military, being unable to do so. It was the SAWA, which basically so many of them, according to the U.S. military, are former Iraqi resistance. These are the people who knew how to find al-Qaeda and go after them and stop their operations, because they know security in their areas better than anyone else, and they would be able to do it again.
Well, Dar Jamil, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. Where can listeners read your work?
My website is simply dar.org, D-A-H-R.org.
D-A-H-R.org, and you have a new article that you're working on about these latest attacks?
I do. It's coming out today on Truthout, and it will be about the attacks yesterday and the cause of them and what's likely to happen in the future.
That is dahrdar.org, and you can also check his latest article later today at truthout.org. Dar Jamil, thanks so much.
Thank you, Sonali.
Dar Jamil is an independent journalist who writes for the Interpress Service, Le Monde Diplomatique, and Truthout. He's also the author of Beyond the Green Zone, Dispatches from an Unembedded Journalist in Occupied Iraq. Later in the hour, we'll take a look at how climate change is impacting, in particular, indigenous people. We'll also hear this week's Black Agenda report. And after today's Subversive Historian, a conversation with author Douglas Haddo about a piece that he wrote on Adbusters magazine called Pornocalypse Now. But before we go to today's Subversive Historian, I want to just remind listeners that on April 28th, that's next week, KPFK is having a major 50th anniversary fundraiser. In light of our anniversary, we've been around 50 years. It's a global dance party featuring Lonnie Jordan's Wartet and Poncho Sanchez's Latin Jazz Band. It's going to be happening April 28th at the Mint at 6010 West Pico Boulevard in Los Angeles. Definitely hope that all of you can come out and not only support KPFK, but have a really great time as well. Again, that's going to be featuring Lonnie Jordan's Wartet and Poncho Sanchez's Latin Jazz Band, April 28th at the Mint, 6010 West Pico Boulevard in LA. You can find out more at kpfk.org. And if you'd like to win one pair of tickets that we'd like to give away today, then call us at 818-985-5735 right now. If you know the correct answer to a trivia question about WAR, group that was co-founded by Lonnie Jordan, who's going to be playing at the event, if you know what year the group WAR was founded, then give us a call at 818-985-5735. The first caller who gets the correct answer will win a pair of tickets to KPFK's 50th anniversary global dance party on April 28th. The rest of you, please get tickets because it benefits KPFK. We'll be right back with today's Subversive Historian.
This is Gabriel San Roman, your subversive historian. Back in the day on April 24, 1915, the Ottoman Turkish government strategically arrested more than 200 Armenian intellectual leaders in Constantinople. This mass detention of influential journalists, political leaders, and artists, among others, was followed by another wave of arrests of hundreds more. Noted as the tripwire event that set off the tragic genocide of the Armenian people that would follow, many of those detained were later executed. Under the authorities of the Young Turks, the Ottoman government carried out a coordinated campaign of annihilation against Armenians that by 1923 had claimed the lives of over 1.5 million people. To this day, the modern Turkish government continues to deny that genocide took place. And after 94 years, the United States government has yet to officially recognize the Armenian genocide. Will Obama break with presidential convention today and use the G word? Or does Turkey still have the U.S. by the giblets? For Uprising, this is your truth professor saying it's no mystery why they conceal our people's history.
Hi, I'm Brian DeShazer, director of the Pacifica Radio Archives. Join me, Amy Goodman, and KPFK General Manager Sean Heidkemper on Friday, April 24th, as we open the evening with a conversation about the state of media today and 50 years of KPFK Radio. Then we'll hear Amy Goodman and her brother and co-author David as they speak on their book, Standing Up to the Madness. That's Friday, April 24th at the Emmanuel Presbyterian Church at 3300 Wilshire Boulevard near Vermont. There will be a chance to meet Amy Goodman at a reception before the event, but space is limited. Call now at 800-735-0230 to make a reservation or to find out more about the event. I hope to see you all there.
There's got to be a media outlet brought to you not by corporations that profit from war, but by journalists and artists. And that's what Pacifica has been doing for 60 years.
This is Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. A new essay in the latest issue of Adbusters magazine by Douglas Haddo paints a scathing critique of pornography, not as a moral diatribe, but from the perspective of a modern man deeply concerned with the negative effects of pornography on men as a result of isolating overconsumption and lacking any significant analog to feminism. The essay, called Pornocalypse Now, opens with a well-known quote by George Orwell: "If you want a picture of the future, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever." Haddo imagines, what if Orwell, instead of having written a novel called 1984, had been born in 1984 and a young man today? According to Haddo, Orwell would probably not be a down-and-out journalist, but more likely a disengaged copywriter, his dystopian prose taking on an entirely different shape and form. This Orwell might have written, "If you want a picture of the future, imagine a boot stamping on a woman's face." The increasing prevalence of so-called abuse porn, coupled with a decline in male sexual health, paints a bleak future in Haddo's essay. He muses that, quote, "what needs to occur now is the genesis of a new masculinism, a philosophy of a man that embraces the achievements of feminism and strives to reconnect with the real." Douglas Haddo is a writer and creative consultant with Adbusters magazine. I spoke with him yesterday about his piece.
There are generally two sides to the debate on pornography as we hear about it in the mainstream. You have the right-wing Christian conservative that can be afraid of sex and being, quote, sex positive. And then you have the liberals who want to pursue sex positivity and equate pornography with free speech. You also, of course, have the third perspective of the pornographer themselves, but you take a different view. What is that view, and how is it different from these sort of mainstream perspectives?
Well, I guess I'm just coming at it from maybe a more industrial perspective, looking at porn as a consumer product rather than something that's inherently dealing with freedom of speech or morality. Or I think I take like an amoral, I don't really deal with the morality of it that much. It's more of just its effect on the consumer, and its effect on maybe the nuts and bolts of sexuality, masculinity, femininity.
I wonder if many defenders of pornography, at least, you know, who openly defend it, sort of realize how hardcore pornography has gotten today.
I don't think they do. I think a lot of defenders are very kind of naive about what's out there. I've read a couple of defenses, I mean, just against my article or in relation to it, where people are just like, you know, porn, you look at porn, people are having a good time, they're smiling, they're enjoying themselves. So, but if you look out there, there's a lot. It's a huge industry, and it's a global industry, and there's a global consumer, and there's a lot of pretty intense product out there.
I wonder if you've seen this, one of the video pieces by The Onion, the satirical magazine about pornography, saying that a new study done showing that pornography might lead children who consume it to come to the conclusion that sex is actually enjoyable, with the implication, you know, and there's a certain implication there, notwithstanding their satire. But again, there's the sense that today's pornography actually shows enjoyable sex. But you start your article with a quote by Orwell: "If you want a picture of the future, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever." Why is that symbolic of today's porn?
Well, I think because abuse porn is like, I think it's growing, and it's growing on the internet quite a bit, and it's basically a just an intense kind of, I mean, it is what it is. It's just very abusive and violent in nature. And I think that's the trend. And I think from a consumer's perspective, once people get conditioned to a certain amount of porn, they constantly need to jack up the intensity, no pun intended, and get more intense, more violent, more abstract. And so that's where I see porn going as the mainstream absorbs the natural porn aesthetic. I see porn going more towards abuse and shorter clips.
How does mainstream pop culture get influenced by pornography, as you just implied, but then how does that sort of feed back into the making of more hardcore porn?
I think porn is just very profitable, or definitely was up until credit crisis, and media in general for the last quite a while has been finding difficulty making money. And so you look at the porn industry and you look at how wild their profits have been in the last 10 years, and I think it's just natural for mainstream media to say, okay, how can we appropriate that? How can we integrate what they have? How can we integrate their product into our medium?
You, in doing your article for Adbusters, spoke with a porn star, Sasha Gray, and it was an interesting description of how you were essentially viewing one of her porn videos on the one hand and then actually talking to her on the other hand. Tell us about this conversation and how she sort of sees the role of pornography in society.
Sasha Gray is, I think she's obviously very pro-porn, but I think she's also a bit of an activist. She's an industry activist, and she's fighting for a union. And she has a very unique outlook on pornography, and I think she's quite inspired. And she mentioned to me how she gets emails constantly from couples saying, oh, look, you've done such great things for our relationship, et cetera, et cetera. And so she believes that porn has a positive effect on people's sexual relations.
And what do you think?
And I think that's definitely possible, but I don't think the majority of people consuming her product are couples working out sex issues. I think the figure of the isolated male is more probably the majority of her audience.
My guest is Douglas Haddo. He's a writer and also creative consultant at Adbusters magazine. He's written a new article in the magazine called Pornocalypse Now that we're discussing. You bring in the issue of male sexual health and how it sort of relates to the pornification, if you will, to borrow Pamela Paul's term, of our culture. Talk about what the danger is on the issue of male sexual health that I think a lot of people don't really know about today.
I think there's a few different dangers. I mean, not just for males, also for anyone who consumes porn. But it's just, I mean, it's pretty simple in just inheriting the aesthetic of pornography. If you're consuming porn constantly, when you do have sex with an actual person, you're gonna reproduce the aesthetics, and that's one effect. You're gonna think, you know, these moves and these behaviors are normal. But also, I think you're just going to be more prone to consuming porn rather than interacting with other people. I think that's a huge issue. And I think if you look at what's occurred in Japan and the whole kind of otaku movement, I think that's definitely occurring here too. It's just,
and what's that? Explain that a little bit about what's happening in Japan.
Otaku is just it's individuals who experience, like, they're extremely isolated, and they live at home, and they're very obsessive, and just kind of mediated through porn and manga and et cetera, et cetera. But I think the idea is that they only experience life through media, and they can't relate to people in a natural physical context. They can, you know, you have examples of people only being able to communicate on the internet, whereas in person they, you know, they just freeze up. And I think pornography, in a sense, has this effect on males who are over-consuming it to do with their sexuality. I think that's one of the big dangers.
So there is a theory that the consumption of pornography leads to the emulation of what one sees there. So, for example, abused porn can lead to greater instances of domestic violence or abuse in sex or even rape. But you think that it actually is the opposite?
Yeah, well, I don't think it incites the libido. I think it just makes men more passive, and it might make them more passively misogynistic, but it's not like an active, like, I'm going to go rape someone because I watch porn. It's more like, I'm just going to stay in and kind of live in my little fantasy world where, you know, I control everything. And in a sense, porn's very similar to video games because, you know, you can experience anything and control anything you want within porn and have any type of crazy sex and anytime you want. And there's no responsibility and you don't have to care about anybody else's feelings. And so it's kind of, you're getting a lot of males who are becoming conditioned to this form of sexuality.
Douglas, you say in your article that due to our toxic living standards and the prevalence of untested chemicals in the social environment, the male gender has recently entered into rapid physiological and genetic decline. What do you mean specifically?
Well, there's been quite a few studies that have discovered recently all these kind of genetic deficiencies that are occurring in the male gender rather than the female. There's a really, really good documentary called The Disappearing Male that anybody can watch online, and it details all the different diseases and just issues that are occurring in males specifically. And so
That result in lower sperm count, et cetera?
Yes, lower sperm count and genital birth defects and male birth rates as well are declining. So there seems to be we've entered into this period of decline where, you know, all these things are occurring to males, but not so much females. And I find it very interesting because it's very analogous to what's occurring with males in porn.
So at the same time that this is happening, more and more men are, and of course there are women who do it too, but in general, it's the majority are men, are consuming porn, particularly with the internet making it so available.
Yeah, yeah. And so I it seems pretty pertinent that you know, males are kind of falling apart genetically and then also isolating themselves in this kind of very unhealthy media atmosphere that's kind of destroying any sort of normative sexual behavior they might engage in. So I think there's there's a link there, definitely, and it's all to do with just a toxic atmosphere and how it affects male sexuality and the male gender, be it chemicals or media.
There's a lot of information about how chemicals like bisphenol A and phthalates and toys affect the sperm count of young boys. Certainly, some people are becoming more aware of this, but by and large, it's still very prevalent, particularly in the United States. I want to turn now to what you say near the end of your piece, Douglas, about what needs to occur now is the genesis of a new masculinism. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think as I argue in the essay on the site, women have undergone this kind of revolution in terms of understanding gender roles and what have you. But men, on the other hand, have kind of been far more passive and less active in this. And I think in order for, you know, things to get better, men should take an active interest in what their role is nowadays.
And then how have men responded, you think, to the feminist movements for the past several decades?
I mean, it's hard to generalize. I don't see much active acknowledgement of it. So it's just men haven't really responded to it.
Other than very sort of ugly responses that, well, if you're a feminist, you've got to be fat and ugly, huh?
Yeah, there's definitely like these very obscene or anti-feminist responses. But other than that, it's just kind of been, it's either that or like nothing, you know. Of course, there's lots of men out there who have responded positively, et cetera. But I think this is really, my point is really tied into consumerism and how traditionally masculinity meant that, you know, you were able to perform functions and do things and provide. And I think, you know, the average person, the average city dweller anyways, isn't able to do that. The average male citizen in a large city is just kind of a consumer. And I think that's one of the things that I was getting at is, you know, be active and create a new role for men in society and kind of rediscover that masculinity as well, because obviously consumerism has been hit with a serious crisis, and something's going to have to come out of this that pulls us forward.
So a new masculinity that actually embraces feminism.
Yeah, embraces feminism, reevaluates gender relations, and so like what is a man in the 21st century? You know, it's like what's occurred here, and I think the whole unemployment thing is really amazing, and how most of the layoffs have hit men rather than women due to women making less money in the workplace, and it's the perfect opportunity for men to reevaluate their role.
I also want to bring in the last couple of minutes we have, your earlier article in Adbusters that got a lot of response, Hipster, the Dead End of Western Civilization. And in this article, you know, the sort of visualization of a hipster is a young white male, at least as it's even shown on the cover of your article. How much of what you talk about in that article is related to this other article on pornography, particularly on the issue of masculinity and male consumption?
Yeah, there's definitely a bit of a relation there. I mean, you can talk about metrosexuals and this kind of men being far more interested in fashion than they were 10 or 20 years ago. I think it's interesting. I was having a beer on a patio a couple of days ago, and a couple of these guys, just, you know, normal looking average guys, walked out of a store with a whole bunch of shopping bags. And I just kind of like, I couldn't imagine that occurring that often 10 years ago, but now it's way more natural for guys to be, you know, just as interested in being fashionable as females. And so in a sense, yeah, there is this kind of masculine component to hipsterism as well.
And so the sort of overconsumption, be it of fashion or pornography, leaves little room in one's life for any sort of meaningful relationship to the world, if you will.
Yeah, it's just, you know, an obsession with the aesthetic rather than anything kind of material or active role in life rather than just consuming aesthetics. I think like hipsterdom is definitely just about appropriating and circulating aesthetics, and that's a sort of language that's developed. But yeah, in that sense it is.
Douglas Haddo, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you.
Douglas Haddo is a writer and creative consultant with Adbusters magazine, where you can find his article. It's still on the front page of the website, adbusters.org. You can also read his blog at www.pblks.com, pblks.com. Special thanks to senior producer Alan Minsky for helping to produce this story. And by the way, the answer to the trivia question we gave earlier about what year was the group War co-founded by Lonnie Jordan, the correct answer is 1969. And Al Brown, one of our listeners, won a pair of tickets for guessing that correct answer to KPFK's 50th anniversary global dance party featuring Lonnie Jordan's Wartet and Poncho Sanchez's Latin jazz band. That's happening April 28th at the Mint, 6010 West Pico Boulevard in Los Angeles. It's going to be a wonderful event benefiting your favorite radio station. Another event benefiting your favorite radio station as well as the Pacifica Radio Archives is happening this evening with Amy Goodman, who, of course, you hear every morning, twice, 6 a.m. and 9 a.m. on Democracy Now! She is in Los Angeles right now with her brother, David Goodman, promoting her book, Standing Up to the Madness. It's just out in paperback. That's happening tonight at 7:30 p.m. at the Emmanuel Presbyterian Church, 3300 Wilshire Boulevard. And you can just show up at the door, and it's a small charge at the door, which benefits KPFK and the archives. There's also going to be a reception, a special reception, where you can meet Amy Goodman from 5:30 to 7 p.m. You can get tickets to that via the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230, 1-800-735-0230, extension 264. This is Uprising. Up next, the Black Agenda Report.
Glenn Ford is a writer and radio commentator and the executive editor of the Black Agenda Report. This week's commentary is about racial profiling.
In 2007, the New Jersey Attorney General issued a directive to the state's local police officers, requiring them to question people arrested for indictable offenses or for drunk driving about their immigration status. In the first 6 months of the directive, New Jersey cops referred 10,000 people to immigration authorities, although in the end, less than 15% of those persons were charged with violating any immigration laws. Immigration rights activists have from the beginning warned that giving police the authority or even obligation to question people about their legal status in the country was an invitation to massive racial profiling. A new study out of Seton Hall University's law school seems to indicate those warnings were well-founded. The study focuses on 68 cases in which police interrogated people about their immigration status for no apparent reason. None of the 68 had been stopped for drunk driving or carrying false documents. 65 of the people questioned were Latino. The others were a Haitian, a Spaniard, and a man from Kazakhstan. 7 of the incidents were in direct violation of the Attorney General's order that no victims or witnesses to crimes be questioned about their immigrant status. For example, a woman who called police to complain about domestic violence was threatened with being reported to immigration authorities. A man who reported to police the loss of his passport was turned over to immigration. A man who couldn't produce a train ticket at a train station was held for 7 days by police and then handed over to immigration. There are several large ironies here. New Jersey is number 3 in the nation in terms of immigrant population and was a battleground state on the issue of racial profiling back in the bad old days before 9/11 was used to mask racial profiling behind a veil of national security. The New Jersey Turnpike became nationally known as a stretch of road where black and Latino drivers ran a gauntlet of state policemen armed with racial profiles. The embarrassment finally wore New Jersey officials down, and they agreed to allow in federal monitors. It was a great victory for civil rights forces. The 21st century began with a kind of ritual burial of racial profiling. Suddenly, nobody was in favor of it. Racial profiling was a shame, a national disgrace, a relic of the past. And then came 9/11, and racial profiling, which had never really gone away, but had only become briefly politically out of season, returned with a vengeance. Now profiling was the patriotic thing to do. Rather than curtailing profiling by police, state officials, like New Jersey's Attorney General, were ordering them to become more aggressive in demanding proof of immigrant status. The final irony is that the New Jersey order was a reaction to a triple murder attributed to an undocumented immigrant in a neighborhood of Newark. It is an overwhelmingly non-white neighborhood whose residents were already effectively profiled by police and government officials of all kinds. It is this institutional profiling that creates ghettos and barrios all across America. Profiling is as ancient as black slavery and Indian hunting. Now, the so-called war on terror adds another layer of profile, another burden that only people of color must bear. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
Visit www.blackagendareport.com for more information. You're listening to Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. A week-long Indigenous Peoples Global Summit on Climate Change concluded today in Anchorage, Alaska. The gathering of hundreds of Indigenous delegates from around the world will bring the summit to a close with a declaration and an action plan to be submitted to the United Nations Climate Change Conference in Copenhagen this December. To that end, representatives also called for the greater inclusion of indigenous peoples and their voices in the drafting of the next international treaty that will succeed the Kyoto Protocol. The summit that began on Monday convened just 500 miles east of the Alaskan village of Neutok, which has already seen the effects of global warming melt permafrost and force the relocation of hundreds of residents. The further disruption of natural systems tied to indigenous ways of life as a result of climate change was central to the discussion held by representatives this week. Rising sea levels and increasing temperatures were noted as concerns already affecting indigenous peoples from Papua New Guinea to the Andean regions of South America. Joining me on the line this morning is Faith Gemmel. She's the director of Resisting Environmental Destruction on Indigenous Lands. Welcome to Uprising, Faith.
Thank you.
So first, how significant was this gathering? Is this something that happens often? Is this the largest of its kind that took place, this global summit?
This global summit is a large gathering that is the first of its...
Faith, we're having trouble hearing you. If you can just speak directly into the phone, your voice is cutting in and out.
This summit is a large gathering, and it is...
Faith, we can't hear you, unfortunately. You know, we're going to try to call you back right now and see if we can get a better connection. Faith Gemmel is the Director of Resisting Environmental Destruction on Indigenous Lands. We're going to take a short break, and we'll try to bring her back on a better line. Thanks so much for listening. And we're back with Faith Gemmel. Can you hear us, Faith?
Yes.
Okay, hopefully that's a better line. So if you can just start over with explaining the significance of this global summit that took place.
Well, the significance is that indigenous peoples from all over the world have come together to address the climate change issue, and there will be a declaration that the purpose is to come together with a declaration to take to Copenhagen, and further, we haven't finalized the declaration yet, and we are trying to instill within the declaration our principles and our values as indigenous people.
Have there been this large a gathering of indigenous peoples on the issue of global climate change before?
I don't think so.
And what spurred it? What led up to this?
I'm not an organizer of this conference. I'm a participant. So as far as I know, it's been that these debates are happening within the United Nations, and governments of the world are addressing climate change, and indigenous peoples have consistently tried to be part of the process. We've had years of the Indigenous Caucus within the Conference of the Parties, and we've had years of declarations from Indigenous peoples. And so we're just trying to be part of the process to raise awareness about our communities and our peoples that are devastated by current impacts of climate change. And we're calling for strong protective measures for our communities and on behalf of our communities and our peoples, that we want governments to take stricter standards to truly address climate change.
Faith, would you say that indigenous peoples are the original environmentalists, and hence it's ironic that they're being left out of these discussions?
Yes.
Let's talk.
We live closest to the land, we are the ones that are hit first and hit hardest by climate change.
And let's talk about some of these instances where global warming has already shown to have a serious impact. I mentioned the Alaskan village of Newtok, which is where the summit is happening. Can you tell us what's been happening there, as well as any other examples that you can give of the effects of global warming? Or rather, the summit is happening in Anchorage, but Alaska itself is, of course, suffering places where global warming has affected lands that indigenous people inhabit.
Yes, my people we live in the interior, and my community is above the Arctic Circle. We see serious impacts of climate change, and these changes are happening rapidly. There's an imbalance on our land as all of the animals try to adapt to these changes. Migratory routes of the animals that we rely on to live our subsistence way of life are changing, which causes stress on the community. And we see massive forest fires due to the drying of our lands. When I fly over my homelands and I look down upon our land, I see that our lakes that were once there are drying up. And when we talk with people that live in coastal regions in the state of Alaska, their communities, the coast is literally being eroded very quickly, and they're forced to face the question of relocation. And that is very stressful upon those communities. And we also see the ice is melting within the Arctic waters very quickly, and this is causing governments of the world to come together to try to claim sovereignty over Arctic waters, so that as these shipping routes are open, there will be ways to bring resources to market that they can develop as global warming happens and the ice changes. It allows offshore development.
So you're saying that they're taking advantage of global warming's
yes.
negative impact?
Yes. Hmm. And communities up here in Alaska, we have 83 million acres that is being proposed for offshore oil and gas development within the Beaufort Sea, the Chukchi Sea, Bristol Bay, and Cook Inlet. And our communities live a subsistence life that's very connected to those oceans. They've lived this way for thousands of years, these coastal indigenous communities, and this plan is a threat to their way of life, their subsistence way of life, and they are raising objection to this. And they're saying energy policy should not target our homelands and the waters that we depend on to live our way of life. It's perpetuating the devastating impacts we already see from climate change. And climate change is perpetuating more proposals within our homelands.
Tell us about your organization, Resisting Environmental Destruction on Indigenous Lands. What sort of work do you do, and how do you do that? How do you actually resist global warming and these very, very large powers that are interested in keeping global warming going?
Red Oil is a movement of Alaska Natives of the Inupiat, Yupik, Aleut, Tlingit, Iyak, which end in the Aina Athabascan tribes. We are demanding our rights to a safe and healthy environment conducive to subsistence. We address the human and ecological health impacts brought on by unsustainable development practices of the fossil fuel and mineral industry. And we address the effect of catastrophic climate change. And in our work, we support the self-determination right of tribes in Alaska, as well as a just transition from fossil fuel development to sustainable economies and sustainable development. We have been working very hard with Alaska Native people that are addressing the fossil fuel industry to protect these areas. We've actually been in litigation and lawsuits, and we have been successful. We won a lawsuit in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals to protect the Beaufort Sea, and that was issued in November. And recently, on Friday, there was another lawsuit that has been won in the District Court of Columbia, which the native village of Point Hope was a plaintiff in, that throughout the Bush administration's OCS, Outer Continental Shelf, five-year plan, which had targeted the Beaufort Sea, Chukchi Sea, Bristol Bay, and Cook Inlet. And we support those communities, and we try to provide information and as much support as possible to Native communities to ensure that they can address these issues for themselves.
Is there a website that listeners can find out more about your organization?
Yeah, it's www.ienearth.org.
Ienearth.org.
ienearth.org/redoil.
And that is www.ienearth.org/redoil, redoil, which stands for Resisting Environmental Destruction on Indigenous Lands. Faith Gemmell is the director of that organization. Faith, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
This is Uprising, and for Sonali, Subversive Thought for the Day, Kwatsina's once said, "We must protect the forests for our children, grandchildren, and children yet to be born. We must protect the forest for those who can't speak for themselves, such as the birds, animals, fish, and trees." That's Kwatsina's, and that's Sonali, Subversive Thought for the Day. Gabrielle and I will be out next week. I'll be at a couple of conferences on the East Coast from Monday through Thursday. We'll bring you the best of our economic coverage of the year so far, and then I'll be back live on Friday. You've been listening to Uprising. To get a CD of today's program, contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or online at pacificaradioarchives.org. Gabriel San Roman is our assistant producer. Stephanie Rivera and Jesse Wood are our interns. Jazz Shepherd is our engineer. You can hear an audio stream of this show after 10 a.m. today at our website at kpfk.org/uprising. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening. See you on Monday at 8 with our taped program. Have a wonderful weekend.